morning.
May it please the court, Jonathan Mitchell for the state of Texas. The district court's preliminary injunction order blocks state officials from enforcing portions of Texas's recently enacted sonogram law, also known as House Bill 15. The district court held that provisions requiring abortion-performing doctors to display sonogram images and orally describe those images to their patients were subject to strict scrutiny and violated the First Amendment by compelling speech. The district court further held that certain applications of House Bill 15's provisions were unconstitutionally vague. Each of these decisions is wrong and should be vacated as an abuse of discretion. The district court's compelled speech analysis violates Planned Parenthood against Casey because it applies strict scrutiny rather than the reasonable regulation test that Casey established for all speech compelling challenges to informed consent laws. Casey's holding is clear. When practicing medicine, a physician's right not to speak must yield to reasonable state regulation. The speech compelling provisions of House Bill 15 must be upheld if they satisfy rationality review, and the district court erred by applying strict scrutiny. The district court's vagueness conclusions must also be vacated, because the provisions that the district court found to be unconstitutionally vague are sufficiently clear to satisfy constitutional due process requirements. The statute is as clear as can be that patients may decline to view their sonogram images, and they may decline to listen to the fetal heartbeat. The statute is equally clear that a physician cannot be penalized because a woman has exercised her statutory prerogative not to view the images or not to listen to the heartbeat. The provisions in Section 171.0122 are exceptions to the general rules established in Section 171.012A4. In addition, when House Bill 15 imposes duties on the, quote, physician who is to perform the abortion, end quote, that clearly refers to the physician who intends to perform the abortion, rather than the physician who actually winds up performing the abortion. And finally, when Section 171.0123 obligates abortion providers to furnish child support information to women who decline their abortion services after receiving a sonogram.
Mr. Mitchell, yes. Help me a little bit with the state's reading of the statute. And in particular, would you explain what a woman may waive or not waive in the course of obtaining an abortion, that is, as she is being given the required information that the statute requires. The statute provides that she may waive, and it also provides that there's a requirement that for the waiver, or at least some part of the waiver, that she fall within one of the three statutory exceptions. I'm a little unclear about what exactly she may waive or not waive without conforming, certifying that she falls within those three exceptions.
Any woman may waive the option to view the sonogram images. Any woman may waive her right to hear the fetal heartbeat.
Unqualified.
Okay. There are a qualified opportunity to waive the opportunity to listen to the doctor describe the sonogram images. So a woman may waive her right to view the images, but she does not have an unqualified right to waive the description that the abortion-performing doctor must provide of those images, whether she views the images or not. For that, she must fall into one of three statutory exceptions. She must either be a victim of rape, she must either be a minor who is seeking an abortion after judicial bypass, or she must be carrying a fetus with a defect. If she falls into one of those three exceptions, she may additionally waive her right to hear a description of the sonogram images from the physician. So women have an absolute right to waive the right to view the images, an absolute right to waive the opportunity to hear the fetal heartbeat, but only a limited right to waive the description of the images that the doctor must provide.
So then stating it in terms of what is compelled. That is what she cannot waive. She must receive the advice. She must, the doctor must give her the statutory advice.
Unless she falls within one of those three exceptions. So there will be some compelled disclosures in certain cases.
But in Casey, isn't it true that the woman, that the state required the woman to receive some document or just make available a document that had fetal, you know, development at various stages?
Yes, this statute goes beyond the informed consent disclosures that were required in Casey. There's no dispute between the parties about that. But that does not change the standard of review.
Isn't that a significant step? Put aside for the moment the consequences of it, but it making available information moves the government from insisting that information be available to insisting that the doctor be the speaker for the government position. The government obviously can state its views, and that's what government does. But that is a significant step in First Amendment jurisprudence.
It goes beyond the statute in Casey, no doubt. But both in Casey and in this case, the compelled disclosures involve truthful, non-misleading, factual information. And both the statute in Casey and the statute here should be reviewed under the rationality test that Casey establishes for compelled speech challenges to informed consent laws.
Well, as I understand it, it's not unusual in the medical field before some kind of extensive procedure is performed for the patient not only to be provided with information but have to sign a form that says, I have read all of this information and I understand it, or something like that.
Yes, compelled speech is a normal part of any informed consent regime, and the plaintiff's position seems to imply that any speech compelling law is subject to strict scrutiny unless it regulates purely commercial speech, and they've created some ad hoc exceptions in their briefing in this court for witness subpoenas.
Are tattoos a medical procedure?
I don't know how they would be classified under Texas law.
State law requires a full description of all the health risks by the tattoo provider and a certification that whoever it is has read them.
Well, that should be subject to rationality review, and there certainly would be a rational basis for that law, as there is a rational basis for this law here. And the district court should not have applied strict scrutiny and should be reversed for doing so. There are two other issues the state wishes to touch on briefly.
Well, let me ask you one other question about those exceptions. You rely on Professor Post's writing, which I found to be very thoughtful. In trying to sort out what are the limitations upon the plain right to require truthful information under Casey and so forth. The question emerges as to the exact relevance of these exceptions, which appear to be geared more to post-viability concerns in other contexts, mm-hmm. To the right to waive at the outset. And that, I don't know if that, in other words, it's not clear to me that these particular exceptions, how they relate to a person seeking abortion. I understand it post after viability. That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. But I'm just unclear about what the relationship is, what the relevance that the legislature thought it was relevant, but can you explain to me what it is?
Why the exceptions are there? The legislature produced a piece of compromise legislation.
Well, what does it have to do with informed consent? Why the level of information that a patient needs, it doesn't seem to me to be indexed by whether or not she falls into one of the three statutory categories.
Perhaps, but in the give and take of the legislative process, these exceptions crept into the statute. The original bill that passed the state house was far more robust and did not have any opportunities for waivers or exceptions. The Senate bill was more lenient, and this was the compromise that the two chambers produced. And it's normal for legislation sometimes not to pursue a statutory goal to the maximum extent possible simply because of political realities and what's possible to get through a given legislature at any given moment. So it would be expecting, I think, too much to expect perfect coherence from a legislature that's trying to bargain over a divisive social issue such as abortion. And this was the most that the supporters of the law could get through at this particular time. One of the issues that has been raised in the briefing is the possible mootness of this appeal. If the district court were to enter a final judgment before this court can rule on the interlocutory appeal, then the appeal would become moot. We want to inform the court that the district judge has scheduled a hearing on January 20th on the competing motions for summary judgment that the plaintiffs and the defendants have filed. So we would think it highly unlikely that the district court would rule before that date. But it is, of course, possible that he will rule sometime after January 20th, and perhaps quite soon after that date. And we respectfully ask this court, if possible, to rule before the district court.
What issues are pending in the district court?
There are several other claims the plaintiffs have brought.
Other claims? They're not re-urging this and these vagueness and compelled speech in a broader context or anything at this point?
Well, they are raising compelled speech claims. They are raising vagueness claims. But the district court has already handled those claims in the preliminary injunction order. They have also challenged this law as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. They have raised a right to bodily integrity claim against this statute. They've raised several equal protection challenges against this statute.
They haven't forsworn any of that in their briefing.
No, not yet.
Okay.
So what's the state's position as to what we ought to do? I spent a lot of time working on this case and trying to resolve it, and then the district judge enters a final judgment that would appear to moot the preliminary hearing.
It would moot the hearing if he decides before this court can rule, but we believe judicial economy would be served by a ruling from this court so that we do not have to, once again.
A lot of courts would defer ruling on their motion until this court had ruled on preliminary injunction, wouldn't they?
Perhaps, but we have not asked the district court for that, and we're not optimistic that the district court would. And we also think the district court's resolution of the First Amendment and vagueness issues would benefit from guidance from this court before he rules.
Preliminary injunction just determines the likelihood of success on the merits, and to hold matters in place until it is decided.
Yes.
And if we got to judge it, I don't know if he's going to decide it now or not. The briefing, I gather that it was before him and that he would plan it on ruling. I don't know, have a clue.
I would expect the district court would reiterate the conclusions he reached in the preliminary injunction order, absent a ruling from this court providing further guidance. Another issue we've addressed in our briefs is the question of severability. This statute contains a strong severability clause that requires not only the provisions of House Bill 15 to be severed, but also the discrete applications of those provisions to each person and circumstance. And the district judge enforced this severability clause for the most part, but he failed to apply the severability clause to his compelled speech analysis. The district court should have severed the post-viability applications of House Bill 15 because those applications will satisfy strict scrutiny under Roe against Wade and Planned Parenthood against Casey. And however this court decides to rule on the compelled speech claim, we respectfully ask that the court reaffirm that severability clauses in abortion statutes must be enforced consistent with the Supreme Court's binding pronouncement in Levitt against Jane L. And that obligation to sever applies even if a statutory provision may be unconstitutional in a large or substantial fraction of cases.
They argue that you waived that issue.
No, we briefed severability extensively in the district court. The district court specifically asked for briefing on the severability clause. Both parties submitted briefing.
No, post-viability. Did you argue post-viability severability?
We argued that every application must be severed, and subsumed within that argument is the contention that applications to post-viability must be severed from.
What's the basis for contending that there's, you know, that this, well, that's only if strict scrutiny applies, but what's the basis for distinguishing this regulation on a post-viability versus pre-viability basis?
Because we have a binding pronouncement from the Supreme Court that states may protect fetal life post-viability and
that's
override.
That's Gonzales, right?
Well, it's Roe against Wade, even. This is the very outset they've held.
Right.
The states can criminalize abortion post-viability. So surely they can take the lesser step of compelling speech disclosures from abortion-performing doctors.
But Casey and Gonzales together suggest that the state has an interest in the fetal life in a from the beginning.
Absolutely. There's an interest from the outset, and that interest becomes compelling post-viability, and compelling interests override any claim of constitutional right, whether it's First Amendment, substantive due process, anything. I see my time has expired. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Reichelman.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Rickelman and I represent the appellees in this case. The district court did not abuse its discretion in the preliminary injunction order. The court upheld the majority of the act and enjoined only a few discrete provisions.
Well, it's the heart of the act to enjoin the sonogram parts of it.
The court enjoined, that was an important part of the act, but it amounts to only four provisions that the district court enjoined. There were a number of other changes made by the act, and the majority of it has gone into effect and is currently applying today. The provisions that the court enjoined require doctors, on penalty of mandatory loss of their medical license, to take actions and provide information even against their patients' wishes. The requirements in these provisions are unprecedented. No court has ever found such requirements to be constitutional, and no state is currently enforcing such requirements. For instance,
would requirements like that, in your view, be constitutional outside the context of abortion?
No, Your Honor. We would respectfully maintain that because principles of medical ethics specifically provide that doctors can't act against a competent patient's wishes, that requiring doctors to provide information that the doctor doesn't believe is medically necessary and the patient feels is not material to her decision would be unconstitutional.
Well, surely you wouldn't say that this would apply to disclosures that this would bar disclosures relevant to assisted suicide because doctors aren't required to do assisted suicide. In fact, that's criminal.
No, Your Honor. We're not suggesting that all disclosures should be subject to strict scrutiny. Instead, the Supreme Court has laid out a number of tests to determine when a compelled statement must be evaluated under strict scrutiny.
Well, actually, you only cite two cases, Woolley versus Maynard and Riley, and it's really difficult to analyze those cases since one involves live free or die on the New Hampshire license plate and the other involves election regulations. I mean, really, you sort of, why don't we start with the governing precedents, which are Casey and Gonzalez?
Well, Your Honor, if I may, Woolley did involve the live free or die license plate. Riley was a case about solicitation, and it actually concerned a provision very similar to this provision. It was a disclosure requirement that was at issue. And the Supreme Court looked at the disclosure requirement, and the state had actually asked the Supreme Court to apply limited review, arguing that because the statute was only compelling a disclosure, the court should apply limited review, and the Supreme Court said no. We need to look at the overall effect of the speech that's being compelled and how it affects the remainder of the conversation.
But again, you have to go back to Casey to analyze this properly. This is not a First Amendment bell non case. It is where, that's where I tend to disagree quite strongly with your position. Casey made it clear, and Justice Kennedy himself reaffirmed the plurality in Gonzalez, that this is not simply a two-party discussion under any circumstances, that the state is entitled to require certain information be given to the woman about the state of her fetus.
Your Honor, absolutely. However, we think the district court was correct that Casey doesn't...
Where would you draw the limits? The state plainly can regulate the medical profession, and you're dealing with physician speech. That seems to me to be quite clear. At some point, then you maintain that the state cannot compel the physician to give certain advices. And where do you draw the line between between what's permissible and what's impermissible for the state to require?
That's exactly our position here, that Casey did not hold that everything was okay and that the state has gone too far here.
Well, I'm not sure when you say that's your position. My question is, how do you draw the line? Because you say something that there are limits to what the state can require, and I just wanted to understand how you would articulate that.
We would draw the line at what's medically necessary and based on information that the patient thinks is material to her decision. So when the Texas Medical Association wrote to the Texas legislature stating its opposition to a companion bill, it said that one of the problems with the act is that it fundamentally changes the nature of the physician-patient conversation because it's requiring physicians to deliver information based not on their medical judgment or on the patient's needs, but based on the government's ideological agenda, and that for that reason this act was problematic because the government shouldn't be able to interject itself into our conversations with physicians in that way.
What is ideological about a picture?
Your Honor, it's not that the picture is ideological. The problem with the law is that it forces the information on the woman, even if she doesn't believe that it's material to her decision.
All it forces is a description, at the minimum, a description of what the sonogram shows. And as you know, up until 2 months, the sonogram doesn't show more than 1 inch, which is going to be not very much to describe. So I really don't see that as being particularly onerous.
Your Honor, we do think that the law is more extensive than necessary. For instance, both Mississippi and Louisiana have sonogram laws as well, but their laws are far less intrusive and are limited purely to an offer to provide certain information.
Did you challenge those?
We did not, Your Honor.
Those are in effect, and there's no legal challenge being placed against those laws?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Good for you.
I ask you a question about in the non-abortion area. I mean, let's just take a hypothetical, which is, let's say, a heart bypass or serious surgery. So let's say that you have a state law that says before a person receives a heart bypass, that he or she has to be given several pages of detailed information about the possible consequences of the surgery, how it could go right, how it could go wrong, must be required to view all sorts of pictures of the anatomy of the heart to understand what's going on, and you have some patient who says, I don't want to read all that, I just want a heart bypass. But no, the law requires it. Well, why wouldn't that be compelled speech that the doctor is required to give the information and the person is required to read it and sign a statement saying he or she has read it? Wouldn't that be the same kind of a problem that you've described here?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we don't think it would be the same kind of problem because all of that information would be information that the physician believes is medically necessary.
But you've told us, I appreciate it, I don't mean to cut you off, but you told us a minute ago that part of the problem is when the patient thinks that it's not medically necessary for him or her to receive the information. But here you're talking about a non-professional patient who has no medical training, so why is it the patient who gets to decide what may or may not be medically significant to know about a procedure?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I may have misspoke. I was speaking about the physician's judgment about what was medically necessary. Certainly physicians should respond to whatever questions a patient has, whether or not they're medically necessary or not.
But you did refer to situations in which the woman just says she's not interested in the information regarding the abortion.
Yes, Your Honor. Our argument is that there is nothing in the record and everything to the contrary that this information is not medically necessary from physician's point of view. There's no testimony in the record saying that it is medically necessary. And because it's medically necessary, it would only be appropriate to provide it in response to a patient's question. So if it were offered to the patient and she wanted that information, of course the physician should provide it to her. But when in the physician's judgment it's not medically necessary and the patient hasn't asked about it, that's the problem with the act.
How do you distinguish this statute from, I don't know whether it exists, but suppose there was a statute requiring compelled disclosure of medical risks of Botox or, as I said, tattoos, where we have looked up the state licensing regulations that are clear. And I don't, you know, tattoo providers are compelled to tell their clients the risks of of the health risks in some gruesome detail and secure consents statements.
Yes, Your Honor. All of that information should not be subject to strict scrutiny because it would be a reasonable regulation because a physician believes that it's medically necessary for the procedure.
No, the legislature believed it was necessary. Most tattoo providers are not physicians. But someone medically told the legislature this was advisable. So the legislature is empowered to make these kinds of decisions, just as the FDA is empowered to require pharmacies, which are medical decisions, to reveal that there's a 1 in a million chance that your skin may fall off as an adverse consequence of a drug.
The legislature is certainly empowered to make decisions, but I think what the cases over the years have shown, the physicians ultimately should have the final say about what is medically necessary to tell their patients, and that when the government...
What about Botox?
Any information that is medically necessary would be appropriately required by the legislature and delivered by the physician. And if I may return to your earlier question about Casey, we think that the district court was correct that Casey doesn't foreclose the claim here for a few reasons. First, Casey did not establish the standard for all compelled speech challenges in the abortion context. Instead, the First Amendment discussion in Casey was explicitly limited to the facts before the court. At page 884 of that decision, the plurality wrote that it saw no constitutional infirmity with the information mandated by the state here, meaning by the Pennsylvania law. And the Pennsylvania law was qualitatively different from the Act. There simply wasn't anything like the enjoined provisions. The only information that the physician was required to tell the woman in Casey was standard informed consent information about the risks of abortion and childbirth and gestational age.
Why isn't it reasonable for a legislature to conclude that a sonogram is ought to be taken before the surgical procedure? I mean, what is your objection to the sonogram?
There's
because
no.
If the objection is that women may see that and make a contrary make a decision to carry the child to term, doesn't that really argue for it? And if you're talking about informed consent. Doesn't consent reach to so that an individual can make the best judgment as to what they're going to do with an important decision?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We think women should have all information that they think is material to their decision. We have not challenged the ultrasound requirement itself, and in fact,
actually,
it's in effect.
You did. One of your arguments that Judge Sparks didn't rule on is that it's a violation of the woman's bodily integrity to be subjected to this. And that's still pending in the district court, according to Mr. Mitchell.
That's correct, Your Honor. We did make a claim of bodily integrity, but it's not to the ultrasound procedure itself. The record is clear that physicians in Texas have been providing ultrasounds before abortions. That is the standard of care.
But your focus is upon the immediate medical consequences of the procedure. In other words, okay to tell them that this is a this procedure is safer than carrying to term, and the actual risk of the immediate procedure itself. But what about the larger consequences of the decision itself, in terms of whether to go forward with it?
Certainly.
I'm searching for where you would draw this line of informed consent. Where does the legislative power cease? And when are you co-opting the speaker here, the doctor? And that's the question. I'm not getting a good answer as to what that is.
We would draw the line at making information available to women, Your Honor. And I believe we would draw the line at making information available to women, Your Honor. And I believe that's where Casey drew the line and where other states like Mississippi and Louisiana have done as well. So under WRCA as it is today, under pre-existing law before the Act, the state made all information about embryonic and fetal development available to women in detailed publications that provide detailed images as well. And women have been receiving that information since 2003. They can.
That's not what's before us. I don't see the difference between saying the doctor shall tell her this information on the one hand and saying the doctor shall hand her a flyer that has exactly, that has the results of the sonogram written in layman's terms. What would you object to that?
We think the difference, Your Honor, is that one is the state's speech and one is the doctor's speech. So
do you object to requiring the woman to be given a written, just like you get any x-ray exam result, that describes the developmental status of the fetus in the same way that the
That was written by the state, Your Honor, or that would have to be written out by the doctor?
It was written concerning the sonogram.
I think to the extent that it would compel the physician's speech, then we would think that it was problematic.
So it doesn't matter. So it's really, what you're really objecting to is the description of this photo, because otherwise you say you're not objecting to making the sonogram available, like posting it on the wall when she goes in there. But you're objecting to telling her what that picture depicts, but you would not object to requiring the doctor to give her a flyer produced by the state which says at 5 weeks the normal sonogram displays this, at 6 weeks the normal sonogram you don't object to that. But from a First Amendment standpoint, isn't it compelled speech either way if the doctor has to give her that information, whether he wrote it or whether Planned Parenthood itself wrote it?
I think it does make a difference for the First Amendment, Your Honor.
What case says that?
Sorrell versus IMS, which was just decided earlier this year, says, I believe, quite clearly that there's a big difference between what the government can say itself and what it can force others to say on its behalf.
Well, I understand that, but they're just as much using the doctor as the conduit if they furnish him exactly whatever script they want to say, including that this is a unique living being, as the Eighth Circuit upheld in the Rounds case. So
I understand exactly.
Well, your argument is there's a difference between the physician saying it and making it available. The legislature here quite plainly, to me, wants the physician to be the speaker, and I understand that. But the question is, and they can do so, at least you'll agree, as to certain to matters that are medically relevant. And so it really comes down to, I guess, trying to make some judgment of to find other limits upon what the legislative judgment is about medical necessity. What's a fully informed patient here?
That's exactly our objection, Your Honors.
You got a 19-year-old young woman there, and they frightened, and et cetera, and then you say there's this information out here is available, the reality will be that they're not really being told very much, other than this is going to be hurt a little bit, but there's no real medical risk to you here, and they go forward. Those are the extremes of the reality of what happens. The question is, how far why can't the legislators require that this information, which is relevant to the whole procedure, I mean, the sonogram is. Now, why is it reasonable to require a sonogram and the time before you go in and evacuate the woman? And you're going to be going in and extracting something without looking at it. I mean, doctors take x-rays before they operate, don't they?
Yes, Your Honor. Our objection is to forcing the information against the patient's will. As I mentioned, there's laws that do this in a far less intrusive way by requiring doctors only to offer the viewing and the description to the woman and then leaving the decision up to her, whether it's material to her decision or not. And certainly those types of...
But the doctor to inform consent requires as a predicate to the decision of the woman that she get the information upon which to make the decision.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but the record is clear that this information is not medically necessary. And for instance, in Texas, there's a Texas Medical Disclosure Panel that's composed of 6 doctors, 3 attorneys, and their very role is to provide list information that must be provided by doctors to obtain a rebuttable presumption that they obtained informed consent for a certain procedure. And they don't include this type of information. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's, excuse me. But they are acting as delegates of the legislature, are they not?
I believe they are.
The legislature could have required this disclosure. It's just, I mean, this is true of all disclosure statutes. You know, the FDA is a delegate of the legislature, which could have written a law that said you have to disclose one in a million risks.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's why we believe the real issue comes down to the fact that this is not medically necessary, and there's nothing in the record indicating that it is.
Let me ask you a more concrete example, hypothetically. There was a great deal of difficulty with breast implants. They mediated the vaginal breast, and I got that information, a lot of information about the difficulties of those and the failures that people were experiencing. Why couldn't the legislature respond to that by, say, requiring that women be told that by the physician that before they could perform those procedures that there is a risk that these implants can fail and and that you could become disfigured? Are that more surgery will you require, et cetera? You would agree, I suppose, that the legislature could do that.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because that information is medically necessary and physicians would believe it to be medically necessary. Even the statute at issue in Casey had an exception to all of the informed consent requirements if the physician decided in his or her judgment that providing any of the information would be harmful to the patient. And the Supreme Court in Casey specifically talked about that exception and said that the statute therefore preserved physician judgment, and it was an important part of why it upheld it as constitutional. This statute goes against physician judgment.
Let me just ask you, absent from your argument, absent from your brief, absent from the district court's opinion, are the recognitions in the plurality opinion in Casey and again in Gonzalez that the state does in fact have an interest in advocating the protection of the life within the woman? And that's stated two times, at least. Why isn't that relevant to the medical consent issue here?
The state absolutely has that interest, and the state can speak and express its views through public education campaigns, through the materials that it publishes and makes available to all women seeking abortions. The problem with this law is that it forces physicians to be the conduit for the state's non-medical message, and under cases like Sorrell, it's therefore unconstitutional. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mitchell?
Judge Higginbotham asked our opponents where they would draw the line. They suggest the line should be drawn for compelled disclosures that are medically necessary. Those would be constitutional in their view. First, abortion-performing doctors do not get to decide what is medically necessary when the legislature of Texas has adopted a different conclusion through democratically enacted legislation. Gonzalez holds that federal courts are not to serve as this country's ex officio medical board. Second, it is instructive to read the petitioner's brief in Planned Parenthood against Casey. Planned Parenthood raised the same type of arguments that the plaintiffs raised today against the Pennsylvania informed consent law. They said it's unethical. They said it violates traditional principles of informed consent. They said it forces doctors to become the mouthpiece for the state's ideology. The Supreme Court gave those arguments the back of its hand. It disposed of the compelled speech claim in three sentences and subjected it to rationality review.
Well, you know as well as we do, Mr. Mitchell, that one can't count on what the Supreme Court's going to do in anything regarding abortion.
That's true, but Casey remains a binding precedent, and for a lower court even to entertain the plaintiff's contentions about what is and is not medically necessary would violate both Gonzalez and violate Casey. The Supreme Court does not care whether abortion-performing doctors think a procedure or a disclosure is medically necessary. Those decisions are to be made by a democratically enacted legislature and not an Article III tribunal. Third, the suggestion that the plaintiffs make that informed consent laws can only make information available to patients is borderline preposterous. They seem to be suggesting that they cannot compel a disclosure of the risk of a medical procedure, but simply offer a patient a pamphlet that might describe those medical risks. Now, I'm not sure whether the plaintiffs are arguing for an abortion is different type of jurisprudence here with respect to this case. But once again, Gonzalez holds that litigants challenging abortion laws are not to get special judicial dispensations on these sorts of issues. And fourth, the plaintiff's argument would imply that parental notification laws are unconstitutional. Those laws compel speech from abortion-performing physicians. The speech that they compel is not medically necessary, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld parental notification laws and has refused to apply strict scrutiny to those laws. The discussion today has shown that the district court's analysis of the compelled speech issues is deeply flawed, and it reaffirms the urgency for this court to correct the district court before it rules on the final judgment issues. And we respectfully ask that the court vacate the preliminary injunction as an abuse of discretion and hold that the compelled speech disclosures in House Bill 15 are constitutional under the Supreme Court's binding pronouncement in Planned Parenthood against Casey. If the court has no further questions, we yield the balance of our time back to the court.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Actually, that's our only argument today, or our final argument, so we are